November 21st. 3 days in Mobile. I spent them walking through the town, searching jobs, and then every night I met my host on the corner opposite the bus station, and we went to his house to sleep. Again, an important part of my daily life was spent searching for the basic things that all whites take for granted. A place to eat, or somewhere to find a drink of water, a restroom, somewhere to wash my hands. More than once I walked into drugstores where a Negro can buy cigarettes or anything else except soda fountain service. I asked politely where I might find a glass of water. Though they had water not 3 yards away, they carefully directed me to the nearest Negro cafe. Had I asked outright for a drink, they would perhaps have given it. But I never asked. The Negro dreads rejection, and I waited for them to offer the drink. Not one ever did. No matter where you are, the nearest Negro cafe is always far away, it seems. I learned to eat a great deal when it was available and convenient, because it might not be available or convenient when the belly next indicated its hunger. I have been told that many distinguished Negroes whose careers have brought them south encounter similar difficulties. All the honors in the world cannot buy them a cup of coffee in the lowest greasy spoon joint. It is not that they crave service in the white man's cafe over their own. It is simply that in many sparsely settled areas, Negro cafes do not exist. And even in densely settled areas, one must sometimes cross town for a glass of water. It is rankling, too, to be encouraged to buy all of one's goods in white stores and then be refused soda fountain or restroom service. No, it makes no sense. But insofar as the Negro is concerned, nothing makes much sense. This was brought home to me in another realm many times when I sought jobs. The foreman of one plant in Mobile, a large brute, allowed me to tell him what I could do. Then he looked me in the face and spoke to me in these words. "No, you couldn't get anything like that here." His voice was not unkind. It was the dead voice one often hears. Determined to see if I could break in somehow, I said, "But if I could do you a better job, and you paid me less than a white man..." "I tell you, we don't want you people. Don't you understand that?" "I know," I said with real sadness. "You can't blame a man for trying, at least." "No use trying down here," he said. "We're gradually getting you people weeded out from the better jobs at this plant. We're taking it slow, but we're doing it. Pretty soon we'll have it so the only jobs you can get here are the ones no white man would have." "How can we live?" I asked hopelessly, careful not to give the impression I was arguing. "That's the whole point," he said, looking me square in the eyes, but with some faint sympathy, as though he regretted the need to say what followed. "We're going to do our damnedest to drive every one of you out of the state." Despite his frankness and the harshness of his intentions, I nevertheless had the impression he was telling me, "I'm sorry, I've got nothing against you personally, but you're colored, and with all this noise about equality, we just don't want you people around. The only way we can keep you out of our schools and cafes is to make life so hard for you that you'll get the hell out before equality comes." This attitude cropped up often. Many otherwise decent men and women could find no other solution. They are willing to degrade themselves to their basest levels to prevent the traditional laborer from rising in status, or to put it bluntly, from winning, even though what he wins has been rightfully his from the moment he was born into the human race. I walked through the streets of Mobile throughout the afternoons. I had known the city before, in my youth, when I sailed from there once to France. I knew it then as a privileged white. It had impressed me as a beautiful southern port town, gracious and calm. I had seen the Negro dock workers stripped to the waist, their bodies glistening with sweat under their loads. The sight had chilled me, touched me to pity for men who so resembled beasts of burden, but I had dismissed it as belonging to the natural order of things. The southern whites I knew were kind and wise. If they allowed this, then surely it must be right. Now, walking the same streets as a Negro, I found no trace of the Mobile I formerly knew, nothing familiar. The laborers still dragged out their ox-like lives, but the gracious Southerner, the wise Southerner, the kind Southerner, was nowhere visible. I knew that if I were white, I would find him easily, for his other face is there for whites to see. It is not a false face. It is simply different from the one the Negro sees. The Negro sees him as a man with muscular emotions, who wants to drive out all of his race except the beasts of burden. I concluded that, as in everything else, the atmosphere of a place is entirely different for Negro and white. The Negro sees and reacts differently, not because he is Negro, but because he is suppressed. Fear dims even the sunlight. November 24th. I hitchhiked up toward the swamp country between Mobile and Montgomery. A magnificent, cool day. I walked some miles before a large, pleasant-faced man halted his light truck and told me to get in. When I opened the door, I saw a shotgun propped against the seat next to his knee. I recalled it was considered sport among some elements in Alabama to hunt nigs, and I backed away. "Come on," he laughed. "That's for hunting deer." I glanced again at his florid face, saw he looked decent, and climbed into the leather seat beside him. "You have any luck getting rides through here?" he asked. "No, sir. You're my first ride since Mobile." I learned he was a married man, 53 years old, father of a family now grown, and grandfather of two children. He was certainly, by the tone of his conversation, an active civic leader and respected member of his community. I began to hope that I had encountered a decent white. "You married?" he asked. "Yes, sir." "Any kids?" "Yes, sir, three." "You got a pretty wife?" "Yes, sir." He waited a moment, and then with lightness, paternal amusement. "She ever had it from a white man?" I stared at my black hands, saw the gold wedding band, and mumbled something meaningless, hoping he would see my reticence. He overrode my feelings, and the conversation grew more salacious. He told me how all of the white men in the region craved colored girls. He said he hired a lot of them, both for housework and in his business. "And I guarantee you I've had it in every one of them before they ever got on the payroll." A pause. Silence above humming tires on the hot top road. "Will you think of that?" "Surely some refuse," I suggested cautiously. "Not if they want to eat or feed their kids," he snorted. "If they don't put out, they don't get the job." I looked out the window to tall pine trees rising on either side of the highway. Their turpentine odor mingled with the soaked smells of the man's khaki hunting clothes. "You think that's pretty terrible, don't you?" he asked. I knew I should grin and say, "Why, no, it's just nature," or some other disarming remark to avoid provoking him. "Don't you?" he insisted pleasantly. "I guess I do." "Why, hell, everybody does it. Don't you know that?" "No, sir." "Well, they sure as hell do. We figure we're doing you people a favor to get some white blood in your kids." The grotesque hypocrisy slapped me, as it does all Negroes. It is worth remembering when the white man talks of the Negro's lack of sexual morality, or when he speaks with horror about mongrelization and with fervor about racial purity. Mongrelization is already a widespread reality in the South. It has been exclusively the white man's contribution to the Southern way of life. His vast concern for racial purity obviously does not extend to all races. Later, I encountered many whites who freely admitted the same practices my companion described. In fairness, however, other Southern whites roundly condemned it and claimed it was not as typical as my informants suggested. None denied that it was widespread. This aspect of Southern life does not hit the newspapers because, as my companion said, "Alabama nigger women are good about that. They won't never go to the cops or tell on you." It was obvious what would happen if one of them tried it. As I feared it would, my lack of cooperation nettled the driver. He took my silence, rightly, for disapproval. "Where you from?" he asked. "Texas." "What you doing down here?"
"Just traveling around, trying to find jobs."
"You're not down here to stir up trouble, are you?"
"Oh, God, no."
"You start stirring up these niggers, and we sure as hell know how to take care of you."
"I don't intend to."
"Do you know what we do to troublemakers down here?"
"No, sir."
"We either ship them off to the pen or kill them."
He spoke in a tone that sickened me, casual, merciless. I looked at him. His decent blue eyes turned yellow. I knew that nothing could touch him to have mercy once he decided a Negro should be taught a lesson. The immensity of it terrified me, but it caught him up like a lust now. He entertained it, his voice unctuous with pleasure and cruelty. The highway stretched deserted through the swamp forests. He nodded toward the solid wall of brush flying past our windows.
"You can't kill a nigger and toss him into that swamp, and no one'll ever know what happened to him."
"Yes, sir." I forced myself to silence, forced myself to picture this man in his other roles. I saw him as he played with his grandchildren, as he stood up in church with open hymnal in hand, as he drank a cup of coffee in the morning before dressing, and then shaved and talked with his wife pleasantly about nothing, as he visited with friends on the front porch Sunday afternoons. That was the man I had seen when I first got into the truck. The amiable, decent American was in all his features. This was the dark tangent in every man's belly, the sickness, the coldness, the mercilessness, the lust to cause pain or fear through self-power. Surely not even his wife or closest friends had ever seen him like this. It was a side he would show no one but his victims, or those who connived with him. The rest, what he really must be as a husband, devoted father, and respected member of the community, I had to supply with my imagination. He showed me the lowest, and I had to surmise the highest. His face was set hard in an attempt to regain his equilibrium when he pulled off the main highway and stopped on a dirt road that led into the jungle. We had engaged in a subtle battle of which I think he had only then become aware. He needed to salvage from it something.
"This is where I turn off. I guess you want to stick to the highway."
I thanked him for the ride and opened the door. Before I could get out, he spoke again.
"I'll tell you how it is here. We do business with you people. We sure as hell screw your women. Other than that, you're just completely off the record as far as we're concerned. And the quicker you people get that through your heads, the better off you'll be."
"Yes, sir." I stepped out and closed the door. He drove down the side road, scattering fine gravel behind his wheels. I listened until his truck was out of hearing distance. The heavy air of evening, putrid with swamp rot, smelled fragrant. I walked across the highway, sat on my duffel, and waited for another car. None came. The woods issued no sound. I felt strangely safe, isolated, alone in the stillness of dusk turning to night. First stars appeared in darkening skies, still pale, and the earth's heat escaped upward. My mouth was dry, and my stomach began to ache for food. I realized I had not eaten or had a drink of water all day. Cold surrounded me rapidly. I got up and began to walk along the highway in the darkness. It was better to walk than to freeze. My duffel pulled heavily at my arms, and I knew I could not go far without food and rest. I wondered at the lack of traffic on Alabama highways. No cars passed. My footsteps on the roadside gravel sloughed in echo from the wall of trees and brush. After a while, a light flickered among the foliage. I hurried forward around the curve of highway until I saw it came from an isolated service station at the top of the hill. When I arrived opposite it, I stood for some time across the highway and watched. An elderly white couple sat inside, surrounded by shelves of groceries and auto supplies, by soft drink machines and cigarette dispensers. They looked kind, gentle, and I framed in advance what I should say to allay any fears they might have of a large Negro appearing out of the night, and to convince them that they should sell me food and drink. Perhaps I might even ask them to let me spend the night sleeping on the floor there. The woman saw me approach past the lighted gasoline lamps. I whistled to give them warning. She met me at the door. I felt an outgush of warm air and heard country music from a radio when she opened. I glanced through the glass to see the man seated in a chair, his ear close to his small radio. "Pardon me, ma'am," I said, nodding low. "I'm traveling through to Montgomery. I got stranded on the highway and can't seem to get a ride. I wonder if I could buy something to eat and drink." She studied me with suspicion, her eyes hard in their wrinkles.
"We're closing up,"
she said, and stepped back to shut the door. "Please," I pleaded, not needing to feign abjection. "I've been without food and water all day." I could see her hesitate, her caution and repugnance struggling against instincts of common decency. She obviously wanted to refuse me. She was also undoubtedly afraid not only of me, but of having someone drive up for gasoline and see her waiting on me. But I recalled the driver's statement.
"We do business with you people."
I waited. The night was cold, the country lonely. Even animals had to eat and drink.
"Well, I guess it's all right," she said with disgust.
She turned back into the room. I stepped inside and closed the door. Neither of them spoke. The old man glanced up at me from a lean, seamed face devoid of all expression. I bought an orange drink and a package of cracker sandwiches. The atmosphere was so inhospitable, I stepped outside where they could watch me, and I drank the orange. When I finished, I returned the empty bottle and quickly bought another. The store had little to offer in the way of food that I could manage. The only two cans of sardines had no keys, and the owner stared at the floor, nodding no when I asked if he had a can opener. I bought a fried pie, a loaf of bread, and 5 Milky Way bars. The woman stood in front of the gas heater and picked the dirt from under her thumbnail with the third finger of her other hand. When I mumbled my thanks, she was so absorbed in her task that she acknowledged my departure only by staring at her hands with a deeper frown. The husband stuck the money in his shirt pocket. I walked down the highway into the darkness again, carrying both duffel bags in my left hand, and feeding myself the tasteless pineapple fried pie with my right. A distant hum behind me caught my attention. I turned to see a yellow glow on the road's horizon. It grew stronger, and headlights appeared. Though I dreaded riding with another white man, I dreaded more staying on the road all night. Stepping out into full view, I waved my arms. An ancient car braked to a halt, and I hurried to it. To my great relief, the reflections from the dash light showed me the face of a young Negro man. We discussed my problem. He said he lived back in the woods, but had 6 kids and only 2 rooms. He wouldn't even have a bed to offer me. I asked him about some other house in the area where I might rent a bed. He said there were none any better than what he had to offer. However, we could find no other solution.
You can't stand out here all night. If you don't mind sleeping on the floor, you're welcome to come with me, he said finally.
I don't mind sleeping on the floor, I said. I just wouldn't want to put you to any trouble. As we drove several miles down a lane into the forest, he told me he was a sawmill worker and never made quite enough to get out from under his debts. Always, when he took his check to the store, he owed a little more than the check could cover. He said it was the same for everyone else, and indeed I have seen the pattern throughout my travels. Part of the Southern white strategy is to get the Negro in debt and keep him there.
It makes it hard, doesn't it? I said.
Yeah, but you can't stop, he answered quickly. That's what I tell the men at the mill. Some of them are willing just to sit there. I told them, okay, so you're going to give up just because you got no butter with your bread. That's no way to act. Go ahead and eat the bread, but work, and maybe someday we'll have butter to go with it. I tell him we sure ain't going to get it any other way.
I asked him if he could not get together with some of the others and strike for better wages. He laughed with real amusement.
Do you know how long we'd last doing something like that?
Well, if you stuck together, they sure couldn't kill you all.
They could damn sure try, he snorted. Anyway, how long could I feed my kids? There's only a couple of stores in 20 miles. They'd cut off credit and refuse to sell to us. Without money coming in, none of us could live.
He turned off the lane into a rutted path that led through dense underbrush up to a knoll. The headlights fell on a shanty of unpainted wood, patched at the bottom with a rusting Dr. Pepper sign. Except for the voices of children, a deep silence hung over the place. The man's wife came to the door and stood silhouetted against the pale light of a kerosene lamp. He introduced us. Though she appeared embarrassed, she asked me in. The subdued babble of children mounted to excited shouts of welcome. They ranged in age from 9 years to 4 months. They were overjoyed to have company. It must be a party. We decided it was. Supper was on the makeshift table. It consisted entirely of large yellow beans cooked in water. The mother prepared mashed beans and canned milk for the infant. I remembered the bread and offered it as my contribution to the meal. Neither parent apologized for the meagerness of the food. We served ourselves on plastic dishes from the table and sat where we could find places, the children on the floor with a spread-out newspaper for a tablecloth. I congratulated them on such a fine family. The mother told me they had been truly blessed.
Ours are all in good health. When you think of so many people with crippled or blind or not right children, you just have to thank God.
I praised the children until the father's tired face animated with pride. He looked at the children the way another looks at some rare painting or treasured gem. Closed into the 2 rooms, with only the soft light of 2 kerosene lamps, the atmosphere changed. The outside world, outside standards, disappeared. They were somewhere beyond in the vast darkness. In here, we had all we needed for gaiety. We had shelter, some food in our bellies, the bodies and eyes and affections of children who were not yet aware of how things were, and we had treats. We cut the Milky Way bars into thin slices for dessert. In a framework of nothing, slices of Milky Way become a great gift. With almost rabid delight, the children consumed them. One of the smaller girls salivated so heavily the chocolate dribbled syrup-like from the corner of her mouth. Her mother wiped it off with her fingertip, and unconsciously, from what yearning, put it in her own mouth. After supper, I went outside with my host to help him carry water from a makeshift boarded well. A near full moon shone above the trees, and chill penetrated as though brilliance strengthened it. We picked our way carefully through fear of snakes down a faint footpath to the edge of the trees to urinate. The moon-speckled landscape exhaled its night rustlings, its truffle odor of swamps. Distantly, the baby cried. I listened to the muffled rattle of our waters against damp leaf loam. A fragment of memory returned, recollection of myself as a youngster reading Lillian Smith's Strange Fruit, her description of the Negro boy stopping along a lonely path to urinate. Now, years later, I was there in a role foreign to my youth's wildest imaginings. I felt more profoundly than ever before the totality of my Negro-ness, the immensity of its isolating effects. The transition was complete from the white boy reading a book about Negroes in the safety of his white living room to an old Negro man in the Alabama swamps, his existence nullified by men, but reaffirmed by nature in his functions, in his affection. "Okay," my friend said as we turned back. Moonlight caught his protruding cheekbones and cast the hollows beneath into shadow. "Okay," I said. The house stood above us, rickety, a faint light at the windows. I could hear the whites say, "Look at that shanty. They live like animals. If they wanted to do better, they could. And they expect us just to accept them? They like to live this way. It would make them just as miserable to demand a higher standard of living as it would make us miserable to put us down to that standard." I mentioned this to my host. "But we can't do any better," he said. "We work just for that, to have something a little better for the kids and us." "Your wife doesn't seem to get down in the dumps," I remarked. "Nah, she's good all the way through. I'll tell you, if we don't have meat to cook with the beans, why, she just goes ahead and cooks the beans anyhow." He said this last with a flourish that indicated the grandness of her attitude. We placed buckets of water on the cast-iron wood stove in the kitchen so we could have warm water for washing and shaving. Then we returned outside to fill the wood box. "Are there really a lot of alligators in these swamps?" I asked.
"Oh, God, yes. The place is alive with 'em."
"Why don't you kill some of them? The tails make good meat." "I could show you how. We learned in jungle training when I was in the army."
"Oh, we can't do that," he said. "They stick $100 fine on you for killing a gator. I'm telling you," he laughed sourly, "they got all the loopholes plugged. There ain't a way you can win in this state."
"But what about the children?" I asked. "Aren't you afraid the gators might eat one of them?"
"Nah," he said forlornly. "The gators like turtle better than they do us."
"They must be part white," I heard myself say. His laughter sounded flat in the cold air.
"As long as they keep their bellies full with turtles, they are no danger to us. Anyway, we keep the kids close to the house."
The fine for killing alligators appears to be a conservation measure and means of controlling turtles, not a punitive action against the Negroes, though few Negroes realize this. The cheerful and fretful noises of children being readied for bed drifted to us as we returned to the kitchen. Physical modesty in such cramped quarters was impossible. Indeed, in such a context, it would have been ridiculous. The mother sponge-bathed the children while the husband and I shaved. Each of the children went to the toilet, a zinc bucket in the corner, since it was too cold for them to go outside. Their courtesy to me was exquisite. While we spread toe sacks on the floor and then feed sacks over them, the children asked questions about my own children. Did they go to school? No, they were too young. How old were they then? Why, today is my daughter's 5th birthday. Would she have a party? Yes, she'd certainly had a party. Excitement like we had here, with the candy and everything? Yes, something like that. But it was time to go to bed, time to stop asking questions. The magic remained for them, almost unbearable to me. The magic of children thrilled to know my daughter had a party. The parents brought in patchwork quilts from under a bed in the other room and spread them over the pallets. The children kissed their parents and then wanted to kiss Mr. Griffin. I sat down on a straight-back kitchen chair and held out my arms. One by one they came, smelling of soap and childhood. One by one they put their arms around my neck and touched their lips to mine. One by one they said, and giggled soberly, "Good night, Mr. Griffin." I stepped over them to go to my pallet near the kitchen door and lay down, fully dressed. Warning the children he did not want to hear another word from them, the father picked up the kerosene lamp and carried it into the bedroom. Through the doorless opening, I saw light flicker on the walls. Neither of them spoke. I heard the sounds of undressing. The lamp was blown out, and a moment later their bedsprings creaked. Fatigue spread through me, making me grateful for the tow-sack bed. I fought back glimpses of my daughter's birthday party in its cruel contrasts to our party here tonight.
"If you need anything, Mr. Griffin, just holler," the man said.
"Thank you, I will. Good night."
"Good night,"
the children said, their voices locating them in the darkness.
"Good night,"
again.
"Good night, Mr. Griffin."
"That's enough," the father called out warningly to them. I lay there, watching moonlight pour through the crack of the ill-fitting door as everyone drifted to sleep. Mosquitoes droned loudly until the room was a great hum. I wondered that they should be out on such a cold night. The children jerked in their sleep, and I knew they had been bitten. The stove cooled gradually with almost imperceptible interior pops and puffings. Odors of the night and autumn and the swamp entered to mingle with the inside odors of children, kerosene, cold beans, urine, and the dead incense of pine ashes. The rots and the freshness combined into a strange fragrance, the smell of poverty. For a moment, I knew the intimate and subtle joys of misery. And yet, misery was the burden, the pervading, killing burden. I understood why they had so many children. These moments of night, when the swamp and darkness surrounded them, evoked an immense loneliness, a dread, a sense of exile from the rest of humanity. When the awareness of it strikes, a man either suffocates with despair or he turns to cling to his woman, to console and seek consolation. Their union is momentary escape from the swamp night, from utter hopelessness of its ever getting better for them. It is an ultimately tragic act wherein the hopeless seek hope. Thinking about these things, the bravery of these people attempting to bring up a family decently, their gratitude that none of their children were blind or maimed, their willingness to share their food and shelter with a stranger, the whole thing overwhelmed me. I got up from bed, half frozen anyway, and stepped outside. A thin fog blurred the moon. Trees rose as ghostly masses in the diffused light. I sat on an inverted washtub and trembled as its metallic coldness seeped through my pants. I thought of my daughter Susie and of her fifth birthday today, the candles, the cake and party dress, and of my sons in their best suits. They slept now in clean beds in a warm house, while their father, a bald-headed old Negro, sat in the swamps and wept, holding it in so he would not awaken the Negro children. I felt again the Negro children's lips soft against mine, so like the feel of my own children's goodnight kisses. I saw again their large eyes, guileless, not yet aware that doors into wonderlands of security, opportunity, and hope were closed to them. It was thrown in my face. I saw it not as a white man and not as a Negro, but as a human parent. Their children resembled mine in all ways except the superficial one of skin color, as indeed they resembled all children of all humans. Yet this accident, this least important of all qualities, the skin pigment, marked them for inferior status. It became fully terrifying when I realized that if my skin were permanently black, they would unhesitatingly consign my own children to this bean future. One can scarcely conceive the full horror of it unless one is a parent who takes a close look at his children and then asks himself how he would feel if a group of men should come to his door and tell him they had decided, for reasons of convenience to them, that his children's lives would henceforth be restricted, their world smaller, their educational opportunities less, their future mutilated. One would then see it as the Negro parent sees it, for this is precisely what happens. He looks at his children and knows. No one, not even a saint, can live without a sense of personal value. The white racist has masterfully defrauded the Negro of this sense. It is the least obvious, but most heinous of all race crimes, for it kills the spirit and the will to live. It was too much. Though I was experiencing it, I could not believe it. Surely in America, a whole segment of decent souls could not stand by and allow such massive crimes to be committed. I tried to see the white side, as I have all along. I have studied objectively the anthropological arguments, the accepted clichés about cultural and ethnic differences, and I have found their application simply untrue. The two great arguments, the Negro's lack of sexual morality and his intellectual incapacity, are smokescreens to justify prejudice and unethical behavior. Recent scientific studies, published in The Eighth Generation, Harper and Brothers, New York, show that the contemporary middle-class Negro has the same family cult, the same ideals and goals as his white counterpart. The Negro's lower scholastic showing springs not from racial default, but from being deprived of cultural and educational advantages by the whites. When the segregationist argues that the Negro is scholastically inferior, he presents the most eloquent possible argument for desegregated schools. He admits that so long as the Negro is kept in 10th-rate schools, he will remain scholastically behind white children. I have held no brief for the Negro. I have looked diligently for all aspects of inferiority among them, and I cannot find them. All the cherished question-begging epithets applied to the Negro race, and widely accepted as truth even by men of good will, simply prove untrue when one lives among them. This, of course, excludes the trash element, which is the same everywhere and is no more evident among Negroes than whites. When all the talk, all the propaganda has been cut away, the criterion is nothing but the color of skin. My experience proved that. They judged me by no other quality. My skin was dark. That was sufficient reason for them to deny me those rights and freedoms without which life loses its significance and becomes a matter of little more than animal survival. I searched for some other answer and found none. I had spent a day without food and water for no other reason than that my skin was black. I was sitting on a tub in the swamp for no other reason. I went back into the shanty. The air was slightly warmer and smelled of kerosene, tosacks, and humanity. I lay down in the darkness in the midst of snores.
"Mr. Griffin? Mr. Griffin?"
I heard the man's soft voice above my shouts. I awakened to see the kerosene lamp, and beyond it my host's troubled face.
"Are you all right?"
he asked. In the surrounding darkness I sensed the tension. They lay silent, not snoring. "I'm sorry," I said. "I was having a nightmare." He stood upright. From my position flat on the floor, his head appeared to touch the ceiling beams far above.
"Are you all right now?"
"Yes. Thank you for waking me up." He stepped carefully over the children and returned to the other room. It was the same nightmare I had been having recently. White men and women, their faces stern and heartless, closed in on me. The hate stare burned through me. I pressed back against a wall. I could expect no pity, no mercy. They approached slowly, and I could not escape them. Twice before, I had awakened myself, screaming. I listened for the family to settle back into sleep. The mosquitoes swarmed. I lighted a cigarette, hoping its smoke would drive them out. The nightmare worried me. I had begun this experiment in a spirit of scientific detachment. I wanted to keep my feelings out of it, to be objective in my observations. But it was becoming such a profound personal experience it haunted even my dreams. My host called me again at dawn. His wife stood in lamplight at the stove, pouring coffee. I washed my face in a bowl of water she had heated for me. We spoke by nods and smiles to avoid waking the children sprawled on the floor. After breakfast of coffee and a slice of bread, we were ready to leave. I shook hands with her at the door and thanked her. Reaching for my wallet, I told her I wanted to pay her for putting me up. She refused, saying that I had brought more than I had taken.
"If you gave us a penny, we'd owe you change."
I left money with her as a gift for the children, and the husband drove me back to the highway. The morning was bright and cool. Before long, a car with two young white boys picked me up. I quickly saw that they were, like many of their generation, kinder than the older ones. They drove me to a small-town bus station where I could catch a bus. I bought a ticket to Montgomery and went to sit outside on the curb where other Negro passengers gathered. Many Negroes walked through the streets. Their glances were kind and communicative, as though all of us shared some common secret. As I sat in the sunlight, a great heaviness came over me. I went inside to the Negro restroom, splashed cold water on my face, and brushed my teeth. Then I brought out my hand mirror and inspected myself. I had been a Negro more than 3 weeks, and it no longer shocked me to see the stranger in the mirror. My hair had grown to a heavy fuzz. My face skin, with the continued medication, exposure to sunlight, and ground-in stain, was what Negroes call a pure brown, a smooth, dark color that made me look like millions of others. I noted, too, that my face had lost animation. In repose, it had taken on the strained, disconsolate expression that is written on the countenance of so many Southern Negroes. My mind had become the same way, dozing, empty for long periods. It thought of food and water, but so many hours were spent just waiting, cushioning self against dread, that it no longer thought of much else. Like the others in my condition, I was finding life too burdensome. I felt a great hunger for something merely pleasurable, for something people call fun. The need was so great that deep within, through the squalor and the humiliations of this life, I took some joy in the mere fact that I could be alone for a while inside the restroom cubicle with its clean plumbing and unfinished wood walls. Here I had a water faucet to drink from, and I could experience the luxury of splashing cold water on my face as much as I wanted. Here, with a latch on the door, I was isolated from the hate stares, the contempt. The smell of ivory livened the atmosphere. Some of the stain came off, and I wondered how long it would be before I could pass as white again. I decided to take no more pills for a while. I removed my shirt and undershirt. My body, so long unexposed to the sun or the sun lamp, had paled to a café au lait color. I told myself I would have to be careful not to undress unless I had privacy henceforth. My face and hands were far darker than my body. Since I often slept in my clothes, the problem would not be great. I wet my sponge, poured dye on it, and touched up the corners of my mouth and my lips, which were always the difficult spots. We boarded the bus in late afternoon and rode without incident to Selma, where I had a long layover before taking another bus into the state capital. In deep dusk, I strolled through the streets of the beautiful town. A group of nicely dressed Negro women solicited contributions for missionary activities. I placed some change in their cup and accepted a tract explaining the missionary program. Then, curious to see how they would fare with the whites, I walked along with them. We approached the station keeper. His face soured, and he growled his refusal. We walked on. In not a single instance did a white hear them out. Two well-dressed men stood talking in front of the Hotel Albert.
"Pardon us, sir," one of the women said, holding a tract in her hand. "We are soliciting contributions for our missionary."
"Go on," the older one snapped. "I got too many of them damn tracts already."
The younger man hesitated, dug in his pocket, and tossed a handful of change into the cup. He refused the tract, saying,
"I'm sure the money'd be put to good use."
After we had gone two blocks, we heard footsteps behind us. We stopped at a street corner, not looking back. The younger man's voice came to us.
"I don't suppose it does any good," he said quietly, "but I apologize for the bad manners of my people."
"Thank you," we said, not turning our heads. As we passed the bus station, I dropped out of the little group and sat on a public bench near an outside phone booth. I waited until I saw a Negro use the phone, and then I hurried to it, closed the door, and asked the long-distance operator to call my home collect. When my wife answered, the strangeness of my situation again swept over me. I talked with her and the children as their husband and father, while reflected in the glass window of the booth, I saw another man they would not know. At this time, when I wanted most to lose the illusion, I was more than ever aware of it, aware that it was not the man she knew, but a stranger who spoke with the same voice and had the same memory. Happy at least to have heard their voices, I stepped from the booth to the night's cooler air. The night was always a comfort. Most of the whites were in their homes. The threat was less. A Negro blended inconspicuously into the darkness. Night coming tenderly. Black like me. At such a time, the Negro can look at the starlit skies and find that he has, after all, a place in the universal order of things. The stars, the black skies, affirm his humanity, his validity as a human being. He knows that his belly, his lungs, his tired legs, his appetites, his prayers, and his mind are cherished in some profound involvement with nature and God. The night is his consolation. It does not despise him. The roar of wheels turning into the station,
The stench of exhaust fumes, the sudden bustles of people unloading told me it was time to go. Men, better and wiser than the night, put me back into my place with their hate stares. I walked to the back of the bus, past the drowsers, and found an empty seat. The Negroes gave me their sleepy smiles, and then we were off. I leaned back and dozed along with the others.
November 25th. In Montgomery, the capital of Alabama, I encountered a new atmosphere. The Negro's feeling of utter hopelessness is here replaced by a determined spirit of passive resistance. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s influence, like an echo of Gandhi's, prevails. Nonviolent and prayerful resistance to discrimination is the keynote. Here the Negro has committed himself to a definite stand. He will go to jail, suffer any humiliation, but he will not back down. He will take the insults and abuses stoically so that his children will not have to take them in the future. The white racist is bewildered and angered by such an attitude because the dignity of the Negro's course of action emphasizes the indignity of his own. It is a challenge to him to needle the Negro into acts of a baser nature, into open physical conflict. He will walk up and blow cigarette smoke in the Negro's face, hoping the Negro will strike out at him. Then he could repress the Negro violently and claim it was only self-defense. Where the Negro has lacked unity of purpose elsewhere, he has in Montgomery rallied to the leadership of King. Where he has been degraded elsewhere by unjust men of both races, here he is resisting degradation. I could not make out the white viewpoint in Montgomery. It was too fluid, too changeable. A superficial calm hung over the city. At night, police were everywhere. I felt that the two races stood like blocks of concrete, immovable, and that the basic issues of right and wrong, of justice and injustice, were lost from view by the whites. The issues had degenerated to who would win. Fear and dread tensed both sides. The Negroes with whom I associated feared two things. They feared that one of their own might commit an act of violence that would jeopardize their position by allowing the whites to say they were too dangerous to have their rights. They dreaded the awful tauntings of irresponsible white men, the jailing, the frames. The white man's fears have been widely broadcast. To the Negro, these fears of intermingling make no sense. All he can see is that the white man wants to hold him down, to make him live up to his responsibilities as a taxpayer and soldier, while denying him the privileges of a citizen. At base, though the white brings forth many arguments to justify his viewpoint, one feels the reality is simply that he cannot bear to lose to the traditionally servant class. The hate stare was everywhere practiced, especially by women of the older generation. On Sunday, I made the experiment of dressing well and walking past some of the white churches just as services were over. In each instance, as the women came through the church doors and saw me, the spiritual bouquets changed to hostility. The transformation was grotesque. In all of Montgomery, only one woman refrained. She did not smile. She merely looked at me and did not change her expression. My gratitude to her was so great it astonished me. November 27th. I remained in my room more and more each day. The situation in Montgomery was so strange I decided to try passing back into white society. I went out only at night for food. My heart sickened at the thought of any more hate. Two, I wanted no more sunlight until I had the medication sufficiently out of my system to allow me to lighten. November 28th. I decided to try to pass back into white society. I scrubbed myself almost raw until my brown skin had a pink rather than black undertone. Yes, looking into the mirror, I felt I could pass. I put on a white shirt,
but by contrast it made my face and hands appear too dark. I changed to a brown sport shirt, which made my skin appear lighter. This shift was nerve-wracking. As a white man, I could not be seen leaving a Negro home at midnight. If I checked into a white hotel and then got too much sun, it would, in combination with the medication still in my system, turn me too dark and I would not be able to return to the hotel. I waited until the streets were quiet outside, and I was sure everyone in the house slept. Then, taking my bags, I walked to the door and out into the night. It was important to get out of the neighborhood and into the white sector as quickly and inconspicuously as possible. I watched for police cars. Only one appeared in the distance, and I dodged down a side street. At the next intersection, a Negro teenager strode by. I stepped out and walked behind him. He glanced at me and then kept his eyes to the front. Obviously, thinking I might harass him, he pulled something from his jacket, and I heard a click. Though I could not see what he held in his hand, I have no doubt it was a switchblade knife. To him, I was nothing more than a white stranger, a potential source of harm against whom he must protect himself. He stopped at the corner of a wide street and waited to cross. I came up beside him. "It's getting cold, isn't it?" I said, seeking to reassure him that I had no unfriendly intentions. He stood like a statue, unresponsive. We crossed the street into a brighter downtown section. A policeman strolled toward us, and the boy quickly dropped his weapon into his jacket pocket. The policeman nodded affably to me, and I knew then that I had successfully passed back into white society, that I was once more a first-class citizen, that all doors into cafes, restrooms, libraries, movies, concerts, schools, and churches were suddenly open to me. After so long, I could not adjust to it. A sense of exultant liberation flooded through me. I crossed over to a restaurant and entered. I took a seat beside white men at the counter, and the waitress smiled at me. It was a miracle. I ordered food and was served, and it was a miracle. I went to the restroom and was not molested. No one paid me the slightest attention. No one said, "What are you doing in here, nigger?" Out there in the night, I knew the men who were exactly as I had been these past weeks roamed the streets, and not one of them could go into a place and buy a cup of coffee at this time of the night. Instead of opening the door into restrooms, they looked for alleys. To them, as to me, these simple privileges would be a miracle. But though I felt it all, I felt no joy in it. I saw smiles, benign faces, courtesies, a side of the white man I had not seen in weeks, but I remembered too well the other side. The miracle was sour. I ate the white meal, drank the white water, received the white smiles, and wondered how it could all be. What sense could a man make of it? I left the cafe and walked to the elegant Whitney Hotel. A Negro rushed to take my knapsacks. He gave me the smiles, the "Yes, sir, yes, sir." I felt like saying, "You're not fooling me." But now I was back on the other side of the wall. There was no longer communication between us, no longer the glance that said everything. The white clerks registered me, surrounded me with smiles, sent me to my comfortable room, accompanied by a Negro who carried my bags. I gave him his tip, received his bow, and realized that already he was far from me, distant as the Negro is distant from the white. I locked the door, sat on the bed, and smoked a cigarette. I was the same man who could not possibly have bought his way into this room a week ago. My inclination was to marvel at the feel of the carpet beneath my feet, to catalog the banal miracle of every stick of furniture, every lamp, the telephone, to go and wash myself in the tile shower, or again to go out into the street simply to experience what it was like to walk into all the doors, all the joints and movies and restaurants, to talk to white men in the lobby without servility, to look at women and see them smile courteously. November 29th. Montgomery looked different that morning. The face of humanity smiled, good smiles, full of warmth, irresistible smiles that confirmed my impression that these people were simply unaware of the situation with the Negroes who passed them on the street, that there was not even the communication of intelligent awareness between them. I talked with some, casual conversations here and there. They said they knew the Negroes. They had had long talks with the Negroes. They did not know that the Negro long ago learned he must tell them what they want to hear, not what is. I heard the old things. The Negro is this or that or the other. You have to go slow. You can't expect the South to sit back and let the damned communist North dictate to it, especially when no outsider can really understand. I listened and kept my tongue from giving answer. This was the time to listen, not to talk, but it was difficult. I looked into their eyes and saw sincerity and wanted to say, "Don't you know you are prattling the racist poison?" Montgomery, the city I had detested, was beautiful that day. At least it was until I walked into a Negro section where I had not been before. I was a lone white man in a Negro neighborhood. I, the white man, got from the Negro the same shriveling treatment I, the Negro, had got from the white man. I thought, why me? I have been one of you. Then I realized it was the same stupidity I had encountered at the New Orleans bus station. It was nothing I had done. It was not me, but the color of my skin. Their looks said, "You white bastard! You old-faced son of a bitch! What are you doing walking these streets?" Just as the whites' looks had said a few days before, "You black bastard! You nigger son of a bitch! What are you doing walking these streets?" Was it worth going on? Was it worth trying to show the one race what went on behind the mask of the other? December 1st. I developed a technique of zigzagging back and forth. In my bag, I kept a damp sponge, dyes, cleansing cream, and Kleenex. It was hazardous, but it was the only way to traverse an area both as Negro and white. As I traveled, I would find an isolated spot, perhaps an alley at night, or the brush beside a highway, and quickly apply the dye to face, hands, and legs, then rub off and reapply until it was firmly anchored in my pores. I would go through the area as a Negro, and then, usually at night, remove the dyes with cleansing cream and tissues and pass through the same area as a white man. I was the same man, whether white or black. Yet when I was white, I received the brotherly love smiles and the privileges from whites and the hate stares or obsequiousness from the Negroes. And when I was a Negro, the whites judged me fit for the junk heap, while the Negroes treated me with great warmth. As the Negro Griffin, I walked up the steep hill to the bus station in Montgomery to get the schedule for buses to Tuskegee. I received the information from a polite clerk and turned away from the counter.
"Boy!"
I heard a woman's voice, harsh and loud. I glanced toward the door to see a large matriarchal woman, elderly and impatient. Her pinched face grimaced, and she waved me to her.
"Boy, come here! Hurry!"
Astonished, I obeyed.
"Get those bags out of the cab,"
she ordered, testily, seeming outraged with my lack of speed. Without thinking, I allowed my face to spread to a grin as though overjoyed to serve her. I carried her bags to the bus and received 3 haughty dimes. I thanked her profusely. Her eyebrows knitted with irritation, and she finally waved me away. I took the early afternoon bus for Tuskegee, walked through a southern town of great beauty and tranquility. The famed Tuskegee Institute was, I learned, out of the city limits. In fact, the major portion of the Negro residential area is out of the city limits, put there when the city fathers decided it was the simplest way to invalidate the Negro vote in local elections. The spirit of George Washington Carver hangs strongly over the campus, a quiet, almost hauntingly quiet, area of trees and grass. It radiates an atmosphere of respect for the work of one's hands and mind, of human dignity. In interviews here, my previous findings were confirmed, with the exception of those trained in professions where they can set up independent practice. They can find jobs commensurate with their education only outside the South. I found an atmosphere of great courtesy, with students more dignified and more soberly dressed than one finds on most white campuses. Education for them is a serious business. They are so close to the days when their ancestors were kept totally illiterate, when their ancestors learned to read and write at the risk of severe punishment, that learning is an almost sacred privilege now. They see it also as the only possible way out of the morass in which the Negro finds himself. Later that afternoon, after wandering around the town, I turned back toward the Institute to talk with the dean. A white man stood in front of a Negro recreation parlor near the college entrance gates and waved to me. I hesitated at first, fearing he would be just another bully. But his eyes pleaded with me to trust him. I crossed slowly over to him. "Did you want me?" I asked. "Yes, could you tell me where is Tuskegee Institute?" "Right there," I said, pointing to the gates a block away. "Ah, I know it," he grinned. I smelled whiskey in the fresh evening air. "I was just looking for an excuse to talk to you," he admitted. "Do you teach here?" "No, I'm just traveling through," I said. "I'm a Ph.D., he said uncomfortably. "I'm from New York, down here as an observer." "For some government agency?" "No, strictly on my own," he said. I studied him closely, since other Negroes were beginning to watch us. He appeared to be in his early 50s and was well enough dressed. "How about you and me having a drink?" he said. "No, thanks," I said, and turned away. "Wait a minute, damn it! You people are my brothers. It's people like me that are your only hope. How do you expect me to observe if you won't talk to me?" "Very well," I said. "I'll be glad to talk with you." "Hell, I've observed all I can stomach," he said. "Let's us go get just roaring blinko drunk and forget all this damn prejudice stuff. A white man and a Negro," I laughed. "We'd both hear from the merciful Klan." "Damned right, a white man and a Negro. Hell, I don't consider myself any better than you, not even as good, maybe. I'm just trying to show some brotherhood." Though I knew he had been drinking, I wondered that an educated man and an observer could be so obtuse, could create such an embarrassing situation for a Negro. "I appreciate it," I said stiffly, "but it would never work."
"They needn't know," he whispered, leaning close to me, an almost frantic look in his eyes as though he were begging not to be rejected. "I'm going to get soused anyway. Hell, I've had all this I can stand. It's just between you and me. We could go into the woods somewhere. Come on, for brotherhood's sake."
I felt great pity for him. He was obviously lonely and fearful of rejection by the very people he sought to help. But I wondered if he could know how offensive this overweening brotherhood demonstration was. Others stood by and watched with frowns of disapproval. At that moment, a Negro drove up in an old car and stopped. Ignoring the white man, he spoke to me.
"Would you like to buy some nice fat turkeys?" he asked.
"I don't have any family here," I said.
"Wait a minute there," the white man said. "Hell, I'll buy all your turkeys, just to help you out. I'll show you fellows that not all white men are bastards. How many of you got in there?"
We looked into the car and saw several live turkeys in the back seat.
"How much for all of them?"
the white man asked, pulling a $10 bill from his wallet. The vendor looked at me, puzzled, as though he did not wish to unload such a baggage on the generous white man. "What can you do with them when you get them out of the car?" I asked.
What are you trying to do? The white man asked belligerently. Kill this man's sale? The vendor quickly put in,
No, no, mister. He's not trying to do that. I'm glad to sell you all the turkeys you want. But where you want me to unload them? You live around here?
No, I'm just an observer. Hell, take the $10. I'll give the damn turkeys away. When the vendor hesitated, the white man asked, What's the matter? Did you steal them or something?
Oh, no, sir. You afraid I'm a cop or something?
The unpardonable had been said. The white man, despite his protestations of brotherhood, had made the first dirty suggestion that came to his mind. He was probably unaware of it, but it escaped none of us. By the very tone of his question, he revealed his contempt for us. His voice had taken on a hard edge, putting us in our place, as they say. He had become just like the whites he decried.
I didn't steal them, the turkey man said coldly. You can come out to my farm. I've got more there.
The white man, sensing the change, the resentment, glared at me.
Hell, no wonder nobody has any use for you. You don't give a man a chance to be nice to you. And damn it, I'm going to put that in my report.
He turned away, grumbling.
There's something funny about all of you.
Then he raised his head toward the evening sky and announced furiously,
But before I do anything else, I'm going to get drunk. Stinking drunk.
He stamped off down the road toward open country. Negroes around me shook their heads slowly with regret. We had witnessed a pitiful one-man attempt to make up for some of the abuses the man had seen practiced against the Negro. It had failed miserably. If I had dared, I would have gone after him and tried to bridge the terrible gap that had come between him and us. Instead, I walked to the street lamp and wrote in my notebook, We must return to them their lawful rights, assure equality of justice, and then everybody leave everybody else to hell alone. Paternalistic, we show our prejudice and our paternalism. We downgrade their dignity.